You're listening to Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Welcome to the BFM studio, Gareth Shute.
Kia ora.
How's it going?
Thanks for having me, Johnny.
Now, you have written transcribed a big old long article that you did with... interview that you did with Chris Knox, 2007-ish.
Yeah, a lot of people over the years have asked me to use quotes from this Chris Knox interview because, of course, he had a stroke in 2009, and a lot of people writing books wanted to use quotes from it, and so I decided that I would just transcribe it and put it all up in Audio Culture so everyone has access to it, because the original is on a 90-minute cassette tape, and I... At the time when I was writing NZ Rock, I guess, would have been the book I was working on, I only transcribed little bits of it, the bits I needed to use, and so it's pretty messy. But, yeah, I mean, he can't speak for himself these days, so it's great to have this, like, quite in-depth interview where he covers everything from the original Enemy, Toy Love period right through to, well, 2007, really. I mean, at least the Tall Dwarf stuff in 2005, I guess he gets through.
What was it like going back and listening to an interview from 2007?
Well, I mean, part of it is I've been doing journalism all that time and listening to my awkward questions that just ramble on. I mean, that was part of the effort of transcribing it, was just tightening up my questions. So yes. When people read them, they think I'm like a good interviewer rather than these like rambling, like checking my notes and stuff.
Yes.
I mean, I tried to leave it a little bit live sounding, like I left the bit in the interview where he gets a album off eBay that he's bidding on and stuff like that, to like get the sense that it was just a friendly chat on his back deck and stuff. Yeah,
it's incredible. I mean, I got about, I reckon, three quarters of the way through. I read part one, part two, and I'm probably half the way through part three, but it's going back and, you know, reading someone's reflections on their, I guess, the history of their time in music, there's always so many good stories.
Yeah, well, he changes so much. I mean, you know, he was older than those other people in the Dunedin scene, so he saw bands like Split Enz when they still were spelt without a Z, and Highway and those early 70s bands, and he was basically, you know, a comic nerd, but he became like a sort of annoying gig attender, like he said to me. You know, I said, how did you go from being this quiet music fan, music nerd, to being this crazy punk singer? And he said, well, I'd been practicing with drugs and alcohol and sex for some time in order to become a monster of some nature. It had gotten to the point where me and my mates were excluded from quite a few pubs around the place because we were so bloody uproarious and insulting and vile, especially to the musicians whose cover bands we totally detested. So it came pretty naturally to express that on stage. So you can sort of get the sense he's always on, like, in this interview. Like, it's a lot of jokes and a lot of, like, you know, he sort of hypes up the language and stuff, so it's a real fun interview. And, you know, just to see how he came from like being a fan of the Troggs and realizing punk was like sped up Troggs, and being into pop music like Yummy Yummy Yummy, and seeing that he has this sort of catchy hook sensibility within him even though he started in punk. And, you know, when he went from the Enemy, the punk band, through to Toy Love, he became more poppy just because the bass player Paul Keane brought along Jane Walker, who was an organ player, but that was sort of natural to him as well. And then to switch again when they did Tall Dwarfs, I think Tall Dwarfs, because it was just him and Alec Bathgate, who was his great kind of guitarist foil, they could just do anything in their ranges, from like noise music through to you know, more sort of melodic atmospheric pieces, like the one we're going to play first, which is Paul's Place, which is off the second EP. And I mean, it's 40 years old, but I think it stands up well. I try to pick some songs that sort of stand up in this all this time later, but you really get the sense of being hungover and hanging out. It's Paul Keane from Toy Love, who at his house they recorded a lot of the early Flying Nun stuff on four tracks and stuff, so it's this crucial kind of place, so it's kind of cool that it gets its own little song.
Shall we hear it?
Yeah, let's have a bill.
Pause, play.
Shoulders in, and you have to go to the safety of the snow. I have not got the strength to leave, but I feel down deep that I really need to. Something's hooked me by the sleeve, and the carpet rears its ugly head to say things I've never heard in my life before in the fold of the throng. A girl goes by outside and she seems to know all about the snow.
By Tall Dwarves.
Yeah, I like the sort of odd things going on there. I mean, that was a four-track recording, but there's a lot of little bits going in and out. And weird percussion as well, with no drummer. They did all sorts of things like tape loops, which were very experimental at that time. And I asked them about tape loops, and it really was just physical cutting a bit of tape and taping it round in a circle and putting it on one track and then playing it into the four track. So it was like a physical loop of tape, if you know what I mean. But yeah, I mean, they went on to slowly become well-known overseas through that as well. I mean, right from the start, The Enemy weirdly got reviewed. Their first single got reviewed in The Enemy. So they had this weird burst of interest then, but later in the 80s, they sort of trickled through the UK, the Tall Dwarfs and Chris Knott.
Seems so strange in an era which is pre-internet that music would travel. I mean, did Flying Nun have distribution throughout the US and the UK at this early stage?
No, originally it was a lot of fanzines, like he talks about one forced exposure. Mm-hmm. But basically it was just mailing cassettes or records to these weird zines that they'd heard were cool. Yes. In America. And Bruce Russell from Expressway was really good at finding those and making those networks. And then they'd get these zines back in the mail and they'd be like, oh, wow, we got reviewed in this thing. Does that mean anything? And like, so they didn't really know until they went over there how big they were. But I think when they had fans at NME and Sounds Magazine in the UK, two of the main editors at both those magazines got quite into Flying Nun, and that's when they really started getting into print. And then 3 months later, they get The Enemy here and went, go, wow, we're in it.
Chris mentions that they turned up to play a show in San Francisco and there's 800 people in the room to see them. I mean, that just must be so mind-blowing because you just would have no idea if anyone's going to turn up, you know, if you're traveling halfway across the planet.
He's so reliant on other people as well because he had the epilepsy that could happen at any point. He couldn't drive himself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, their first tour they did through Europe was with Phil Morrison driving, who's the director later of Junebug and stuff, and they just had like a station wagon and drove through him the clean, and then, you know, randomly going to New York and staying with Gerard Cosloy, who happens to start these labels like running Homestead and starting Matador later on. Mm-hmm. And stuff. So it was this weird network, and Gerard Cosloy was playing bass for Gigi Allen at that point, if you know him, the musician who'd like shit on stage and always said he was going to commit suicide on stage. Unfortunately, he had an overdose and died that way instead. But yeah, Chris, there's a quote I was going to read about Chris just talking about the audiences in America being shocked, like hearing these songs that they all thought were so arty and experimental.
Yes.
He said, "A lot of them thought I'd be really serious and quite dour with like some of my lyrics. I think they got quite a shock to see that, one, I couldn't play properly, and two, it was rickety as hell and I was dressed funny with jandals and shorts and so forth. I'd bleached my hair blonde at that point too, just this pathetic idiot on stage, fucking up songs and getting people on stage and being a clown. That took a lot of them a bit of getting used to. Some of them were mortally offended by the fact that I didn't take the song that had changed their lives completely seriously. Likewise with the clean, but in a slightly more diluted form because they could actually play." So he's got that kind of great humour.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, he got known for those solo acts where he'd, because along with Tall Dwarfs at a certain point, he started doing solo tracks as well. And so he'd just play with a distorted guitar and like a headset microphone, which was like the uncoolest thing. It was only something that pop stars play with in those days. But the Tall Dwarfs would be experimental, where Alec would just turn up and they'd record it on the spot, and then Chris Knox albums would be the more thought out ones. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd play this one, Lapse, which is off his second album, Croker, which was end up being a big album because Croker and the one before it, Sees You, were combined as the album Meet and released through an overseas label and got a lot of coverage. So check this one out as another side of Chris Knox's music, I guess.
Ah.
the mellower side of Chris Knox?
Yeah, I guess I'm playing mellow ones. I hope that's not wearing people out on this rainy day. It was my mood, I guess, when I was picking them this afternoon. I mean, it really does reflect how Chris Knox changed over time from that punk who would like cut himself and stuff. Mm. And in the interview that I published on Audio Culture that we're discussing, there's a quote I was going to read actually where he talks about how it sort of changed. He says, "I was playing a Tall Dwarfs gig at Sammy's in Dunedin, always Dunedin. I got really pissed off with the audience who were all sitting cross-legged on the floor and sending back no energy at all. As a performer, the more energy an audience sends to you, the more you can give back to them, which makes a great gig. It's really hard doing it to a bunch of people sitting on the dance floor cross-legged. I got really pissed off and berated them at length between songs and went on about what a cesspit Dunedin was and so forth. Then on the bus up to Christchurch, I sat there thinking to myself, I was right, but I should have expressed it with humour, not anger. Mm. At that point, I stopped being angry on stage and just became funny as I could be." So that kind of shows, I think, like, yeah, he was like real in your face as a punk singer, but through his solo career, I think he worked out that he could tempt people up on stage in different ways and get them involved rather than trying to be in their face. He is a funny performer in that he's so anti the Kiwi arms folded gig watching kind of audience, and he really worked against that. Mm. But overseas, I mean, it's amazing how big they did become, you know. Like I said, Gerard Cosloy, who he stayed with on that very first overseas trip, was one of the people behind Matador, which was a big label, so they did the Yes album, and then he did other albums through like Communion, Caroline, and some of them got on the top of the CMJ charts. And there was even a weird point, an anecdote that he tells in the Audio Culture interview where he discusses playing with Green Day, which was this weird situation where this gig had been booked like ages in advance with Green Day, this very tiny punk band from America. Mm-hmm. We're going to support Tall Dwarfs in Germany. And then when they turned up, of course, though, in the interim, Green Day had become this massive superstar band because Dookie had blown up.
Yeah, just dropped Dookie.
Yeah.
So
but
just,
they still agreed to do the date. So weirdly, Tall Dwarfs, knowing nothing, just turn up at the show. They're headlining. Mm. Green Day come. They look exhausted. They're lying around looking trash. And then they get up and play this killer set, and the place is packed with fans. And then Tall Dwarfs have to go on afterwards. So they have insane things like that. And they like, in the 90s, they played support for Blondie. Yep. And then toured a lot with like Yola Tengo and Smog and people like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really shown that it's worth going back to read these Chris Knox interviews and his enduring influence. I mean, I had a job once in the 15 years ago or something, driving around everyone from Sub Pop and the American label, driving them around the west coast of the New Zealand. The owner brought them over for a holiday. Mm-hmm. And the New Zealand acts they'd heard of were just Chris Knox and Dead Sea. Mm-hmm. It was quite a different kind of realization that, oh, it's just because some of these Flying Nun bands were big in England, a lot of them didn't really break in America, but yes, Chris Knox and the Bats and Tall Dwarfs really did. Mm-hmm. And so I thought last I'd just play something off the Stroke album, which was the album that they put together to support him after he had his stroke in 2009, yes, which was had the most amazing lineup. It's really worth going back to the album. It's like, you know, Smog on there, of course. Jay Retard does a really good cover of Pull Down the Shades. There's just amazing sort of acts from here and overseas. Yola Tengo. But I thought I'd play the Mint Chicks one. I just thought it was a bit more upbeat, and it kind of, interestingly, it's a really old Tall Dwarfs one as well, and it really kind of, you can hear what they've done with the loop, and I feel like it really shows how Chris Knox, the best of Chris Knox's music still holds up today. So
excellent.
I hope people go back to Audio Culture and have a read of the interview.
Yeah, totally. I can
rediscover it.
I can, I'll vouch, Gareth. As I said, I've tucked through most of the article or articles, 3-part interview on Audio Culture on Chris Knox. Fantastic. You know, there's some great stories in there. Dig in, everyone. Check it out.
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome, mate.
That was
Audio Culture on 95 BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's done.